I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, Mayor Gina Ortiz-Jones delayed a vote for an ordinance aimed at punishing people who abandon animals in San Antonio. But the proposal to fine people caught dumping unwanted pets will get a council vote after all. District 7 Councilmember Marina Aldarete-Gavito joins us to explain the ordinance and the latest power struggle in City Hall over process. And later on The Source, the state of Texas is making it easier for parents to exempt their children from receiving school-required vaccinations. Many are saying it's now too easy to opt out of the disease-preventing shots. Meanwhile, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is making it harder for many to get the COVID vaccination while COVID is spreading once again. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Did you know that many employees qualify for a matching gift through their workplace? Getting started is quick, easy, and can significantly boost your support for Texas Public Radio. Visit tpr.org/workplacegiving to see if your employer participates and maximize your impact today. Visit tpr.org/workplacegiving to see if your employer participates and maximize your impact today.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A bit later, we're going to be hearing about how Republican state leaders are making it easier to opt out of childhood vaccinations and what does that mean for public health. But first, another clash at City Hall between Mayor Gina Ortiz-Jones and the City Council over policy process. This time, it's about dumping dogs and other unwanted pets. Mayor Jones pulled an ordinance from a council vote on raising fines for anyone caught abandoning animals. But now, in an unusual move, it is back on the agenda. District 7 Councilmember Marina Aldarete-Gavito was here to explain the ordinance and what happened with this vote. And Councilmember Gavito, welcome back to The Source.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first off, what is this ordinance about dumping animals? So there's already like a penalty for that, right?
Yeah, under the Texas Penal Code, there is a law prohibiting dumping of animals. However, people usually only get cited if there's harm or injury to the animals. What we're trying to do in this ordinance is say the actual act of abandoning animals throughout the city of San Antonio is uncalled for, and there's going to be some hefty fines associated with it.
Because I've seen it at local parks.
Yep.
People will dump cats and mm-hmm. dogs, unwanted dogs. Maybe they can't handle a dog anymore for whatever reason, and they just take it to a park and, you know, throw it out and then drive off. And then those dogs are left wandering around. Sometimes they become feral and they attack people.
That's right.
And so it's a public safety issue.
It is a public safety issue. And, you know, with my loose and dangerous dog policy proposal that I have been pushing in my first term, we know that these cause life issue, you know, life safety issues for so many residents. And so we're trying to just get tougher on it. And people cannot, we have to change the culture. You can't let your dog out. You can't abandon animals on our streets in San Antonio.
We've seen some horrific examples
of
dogs attacking people. So this is a non-controversial issue. You see this as something that you've heard broad and wide support from your supporters that mm-hmm. this is what they want.
Yep.
Other council members say this is what they want. This should have been something that, you know, you did all the work mm-hmm. in the committee hearings and working with the animal control people. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, but then it looked like it was on its way to a council vote. But what happened?
So Wednesday evening before the Thursday A session where it was supposed to be up for a vote, I received a call from city staff saying that the mayor had pulled the item. First, I understood that she may pull it to ask questions, but they were like, no, she's completely withdrawing the item. So, you know, I kind of start scratching my head, like, why would we withdraw this item? This is, you know, it's been on the public agenda for a couple of days now. And this is a no-brainer. And so, you know, sure enough, it was pulled, and I
So when you say pulled, so it would no longer be on the agenda, so it cannot be addressed or voted on.
That's right. So, yeah, and essentially, I guess I should say withdrawn. So, you know, once again, I joined forces with my colleagues, Councilman Mark White and Councilwoman Terry Castillo, to say this isn't right. You know, this is what residents want. And so we again signed a 3-signature memo to put it back on the agenda for next Thursday.
That's been described as an unusual move. That's in the charter. Where does that authority come from?
Yeah, the 3-signature memo really allows council to agendize items. It isn't a tool that we use often. Obviously, you saw us 3 use it previously when the mayor tried to unilaterally change our council consideration request process. We weren't happy about that. And I mean, even if you look at who I'm teaming up with, Councilman Mark White leans pretty heavy right, Councilwoman Terry Castillo leans pretty heavy left, I'm smack dab in the middle. It should signal this isn't about politics. This is just about us trying to get work on behalf of the residents done.
Well, did you hear from Mayor Jones on why she withdrew this ordinance from that meeting?
No, I'd never heard from her on why she chose to. In subsequent media interviews, I heard her mention that, you know, she wants to give new council members the time to understand this policy. But, I mean, to me, this is a briefing, right? And Animal Care Services had briefed all the council members, to my understanding. A briefing happens all day, every day at City Hall, right? We get caught up on the issue. We're allowed to ask questions, push back if needed, and go from there. So
this isn't like a multi-billion-dollar stadium deal. This is a ordinance trying to protect the public, trying to encourage people not to dump animals and to put more authority into a policy, which right now we already have, but it's just not working because we need some more muscle behind it.
That's right. Yeah, we needed some local muscle behind it, really. And again, it's really banning the act of abandoning animals here, which again is a no-brainer.
So it's back on the agenda?
Yes, we put it back on this week's agenda.
So you'll be voting on it.
Mm-hmm.
Do these types of kerfuffles on city council between the mayor and the council, or at least the 3 of y'all, mm-hmm. is this having a poisoning effect on the relationship that y'all have, a working relationship?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I know that there's been talks of if she's doing this to retaliate against me, committee chair positions. I'm not sure. I don't know, and I don't care. You know, what I do care about is getting the work of residents done, whether it's cluster mailbox theft, which is another CCR I pushed forward, public works reset to address the construction on our streets that I partnered with Councilwoman Dr. Secor and Councilwoman Terry Castillo on, whether it's this ordinance so that people cannot abandon animals. I mean, this is the work of our residents, and we're just going to push forward by any means to get our work done.
If the Mayor Jones had her way and was pulled and you had to start from square one all over again to bring this, how much of a delay would that be before we could get to a council? You had to start with the committees and do all the things all over again?
I mean, it's a several month long process. You know, I've been working on this CCR, which actually originally started with a PFOWL or Peacock CCR. I mean, I feel like it's been probably almost a year, a little over a year. But if we were to start from scratch, you're talking about all the taxpayer dollars that have gone to city staff working on this, all of our meetings, all of our work just being wiped.
But just the bureaucracy of slowing it down.
It's crazy. It's crazy. That's not what we need. We need to get stuff done.
But could you have a conversation with Mayor Jones and explain that to her? Have you had an opportunity to do that?
Yeah, I mean, even in one of my initial CCRs that I looked to expand the radius of transporting seniors to senior centers. This is a overall good thing, right? We want our seniors in senior centers. You know, she pushed back and issued a press release against it. And I just picked up the phone and called her and was able to get a hold of her. And I said, hey, this is how the CCR process works.
But is this growing pains? Y'all are working this out and soon, because it's still kind of a new council, new mayor tenure.
Well, I would say the my current, the new council members actually have a lot of experience with CCRs because
they've been on staff.
Yeah, they've been on staff. They know how this works.
All right. Well, Marina Aldereta Gavito, a council member from District 7, thanks for coming in the studio today and helping us understand this process, this new ordinance. Do you think it'll pass this week?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident it will.
All right. Well, welcome you back anytime. Yeah. We'll talk about this and other issues. And when we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about vaccinations. Why is the state making it easier for parents to opt out of having their children get vaccinations when they go to school? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Now, it's never been easier for parents in Texas to sidestep childhood vaccinations. On September 1st, a new law went into effect that allows the downloading from the internet a form that grants an exemption for school vaccinations. This law was passed by the Texas legislature just as the state was dealing with the worst measles outbreak in 30 years, which took the life of two young girls. There seems to be a strong anti-vax movement in Texas and other parts of the nation, despite widespread support for vaccinations by the general public. Meanwhile, there's a lot of confusion about who can get the COVID shot, as the COVID numbers are once again climbing. To help help us understand what is happening, we are joined by Terry Burke. She is the executive director of the Immunization Partnership. Terry, welcome back to The Source.
Thanks so much for inviting me, David.
And also,
always good to be talking to you.
Yeah, and also with us is Dr. Aaron Carlson, a clinical professor, the director of the Graduate Public Health Program at the College of Nursing and Health Innovation at UT Arlington. And Dr. Carlson, welcome to The Source.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, Terry, I'm going to ask you first off, this new law that allows parents, makes it easier for parents. Is it too easy now, or what is the concern that this law is now in effect? How does it work?
Yeah, so the concern is that a policy that was implemented in the state of Texas, and it was legislated in 2003, I believe, it was a policy designed to give parents the opportunity to make a conscious and conscientious decision about whether to vaccinate their children. And that process involved seeking a form from the Department of Health Services, having it mailed to them, completing it, notarizing it, turning it in. Took about probably 2 weeks, given length of time for mail, etc. This new system allows a parent to download a form the day school starts. Previously, they were mailed up to 5 forms. Now they could download it and make 100 copies and, you know, pass it out in the neighborhood, I guess. It doesn't suggest thoughtful decision making. It suggests, oh dear, school is starting, our kids aren't vaccinated, well, we'll just exempt them. And, you know, even those of us with the best of intentions of saying, well, I'll get the exemption today and I'll take the kids down the road to the doctor, things get in the way, it doesn't happen, and pretty soon the school year is gone and those children aren't immunized against very basic diseases. If a parent has a conscientious objection to vaccination, they know that before the day school starts. And I don't think they needed this process to be easier.
Well, what is a conscientious objection to vaccination of your children? What would that look like?
I'm hard-pressed to answer that, David, because I vaccinated my children, our granddaughter's vaccinated. I don't know what a conscientious objection is, but there are parents who rightly and understandably have questions. They are hesitant. They need more information sometimes. But that results in them saying, well, you know, I don't believe in this. I believe in more natural ways of protecting our children. I believe in what's called herd immunity. I just want to see the herd immunity work. Things like that.
Well,
and let me add.
Well, ask Dr. Carlson about this.
Yeah.
How does making it easier for parents to opt out of childhood vaccinations, what does that do for overall herd immunity, and what does that mean?
Well, I think what we saw.
Let me get Dr. Carlson to jump in.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, this undermines herd immunity, as we saw in the recent measles outbreak. Measles is highly contagious, taking measles as an example here. So for every one person infected with measles, they infect about 17 other people. It's the most highly infectious disease that we have. So we require 95% vaccination levels to have herd immunity against something as contagious as measles. So when our vaccination levels drop below 95%, we now have compromised herd immunity. Currently, our vaccination levels in Texas and kindergartners, and Terry knows better than I do, but my understanding is that we have dropped below 95% for our vaccination levels. And so we have already compromised our herd immunity.
Right. And so herd immunity, so it's not all kids can get vaccinated because they may have immunization compromised conditions, whether they have childhood cancer or some other conditions. And so we want to have strong herd immunity in order to protect those children. Herd immunity is not there to protect the parents of kids that they don't want to be vaccinated because they oppose vaccinations. I mean, Terry, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, they, you know, and again, I don't want to paint parents who don't vaccinate with the same brush. They've done their research. Many of them have genuine concerns about vaccine ingredients, what they've heard about side effects, seen much of which we know from scientific evidence is not correct, but they have their sources and they rely on those sources. But the fact is, Gaines County, Texas, proves that when you have low vaccination rates, you have an outbreak. Aaron knows the right term for an epidemic. What level does it have to be an epidemic? But I think 750 cases in one region, by my definition, looks like an epidemic. And there were 18% of the kindergartners in Gaines County were not vaccinated. And that's an area where there's significant homeschooling. So we really don't know how many kiddos weren't vaccinated there. And here's the thing, Seminole, Texas, which is the heart of Gaines County, is 20-minute drive from Hobbs, New Mexico. And most folks in Seminole do their commerce in Hobbs. So the fact that all those folks were unvaccinated and they were traveling over to Hobbs to buy groceries and shop, et cetera, I mean, the exposure rates just were exponential. And again, as we mentioned, kiddos who are immunocompromised or adults who are immunocompromised, who have underlying health conditions, who can't be vaccinated, are put at incredible risk.
Our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, if you want to sound off on this policy, this new law that went into effect here in Texas on September 1st. And if Texas is taking vaccinations seriously, or is our Texas lawmakers being overly sensitive to the whims of the anti-vax movement, give us a call, 833-877-8255. So, Dr. Aaron Carlson, what are your concerns about the fact that this became law, that this is something that was debated in the legislature and passed both houses, and now it seems like this is something that if we had lawmakers who were paying attention, this probably, we had that measles outbreak, this seems to not really pay attention to what was happening in the state.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have a lot of concerns from a scientific perspective. Vaccines are public health's best tools for protecting all of us, but especially the most vulnerable. And when we say the most vulnerable, we are, the majority of who we're talking about are small children, children under age 5. Their immune systems are not fully developed yet. And so when we say the most vulnerable, we are talking often about small children. And so it's very concerning that we are not protecting our most vulnerable. And it does take nearly everyone who can be vaccinated to be vaccinated to have that herd immunity, because as Terry said, there are some who physically, medically cannot be vaccinated. It's also very concerning, David, because we have an obligation not only to our own community, but this is also a responsibility to others. So Terry mentioned how close we are to the New Mexico border and how close that outbreak happened. Diseases do not know to stay within county boundaries, within state boundaries, or even within national boundaries. And so part of the responsibility we have is for others as well. It's not only an individual responsibility, but it's a responsibility to others with whom we interact to help protect them. And so that's something that's very concerning about this. What happens here happens throughout the state, it happens throughout the country, and it happens globally. What is global is local with disease. And so that's something we also have to understand.
Terry, let me ask you about another law that was passed in the legislature, SB 269, which reporting a vaccine or drug-related serious adverse effects. It requires if someone was got a vaccination and they had a serious adverse effect, you know, within 1 year of the administration of that vaccine, then they would have to report that to the federal government. I'm not really clear, what is a serious adverse event that you would get from a vaccine even 1 year after getting it? Because how do you know that something that happened to someone is due to that vaccination?
Well, you know, I'm not a physician, I'm not a health person, but I think that a year later does seem a bit extreme. The real problem with that bill, or the real, you know, complaint I would have with that bill, is that the national VAERS system, vaccine adverse event reporting system, that has been in place for many, many years, requires people to report adverse events related to vaccines. That requirement is already there. And so you go in, you get a shot, and you have a reaction, you call your physician who's going to ask questions, maybe say, let's wait 2 days, who knows. But at any rate, the physician is going to follow you carefully to monitor that reaction. I'm one of those people who, I never get a COVID shot or a booster that I don't have about a 36-hour episode of having the flu, you know. I quit calling my doctor. But, you know, if I did, I think my physician would say, let's give it 36 hours because that's your usual pattern. You know, and then they follow it. And then they, and if it does become something really unusual, it gets reported to VAERS. And that is because we have an elaborate system in this country of monitoring vaccines long after they are approved, long after they're on the market, long after, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, have had the shots. We continue, our government, the CDC, the FDA, a number of organizations, continue to monitor their effectiveness and safety. So the VAERS is a critically important a system for doing that. So the real point is, this was just another case, in my opinion, of the legislature having doing performative legislation. There was no point in it, there was no purpose in it, there was no need for it.
Well, it does satisfy the demands of the people who are opposed to vaccinations or
sure.
vaccine skeptics. And also, this could, you know, just adds to this bias that people have in that field, who think that vaccines cause more harm than good, and they are out looking for evidence to support that line of thought, ignoring the, you know, you can't report all the people who didn't get measles. You can only report, you know, people who may have gotten a sore arm from getting the measles shot, Terry.
Could I jump in there?
Yeah, we're real short on time, but I'll get you. I'm going to get you back when we come back from this break. I'll ask you to respond to that because I don't want to cut you off mid-sentence. And our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're talking about efforts to make it easier to avoid getting vaccinations. Also, we're going to be hearing about how the CDC is making it harder to get the COVID vaccine also, and other issues. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about vaccinations, childhood vaccinations, whether or not you can get your COVID shot due to changes at the CDC. The caller number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, if you want to call in. And let's go to Dr. Aaron Carlson, a clinical professor, director of the Graduate Public Health Program at the College of Nursing and Health Innovation, UT Arlington. And Dr. Carlson, I'm sorry I cut you off there, but please, can you pick up the thread?
Absolutely, David. Thanks for the opportunity. So I want to piggyback on Terry's very good message about the safety of vaccines and how they're monitored. And something that we like to discuss in public health is the risk-benefit analysis of vaccines compared to getting sick. So vaccines have about literally a 1 in 1 million. 1 in 1 million people who get a vaccine will have a severe allergic reaction. Okay, there is a risk there, right? 1 in 1 million, absolutely. You'll also have mild side effects. You'll have a sore arm, you'll have the fever, maybe some of us get a fever. Sometimes there's a rash in children, okay? But then if you don't get vaccinated and you get the disease, for instance, measles, 1 in 5 children to 1 in 6 children require hospitalization for measles who get it. 1 in 1,000 will develop encephalitis, that's brain swelling, okay? 1 in 1,000 children who has measles will die from it, even if they're hospitalized, even with modern medicine. So the bottom line here is that the disease is literally hundreds of times more dangerous than the vaccine.
But we've developed a sensitivity to people who are injured by the vaccine, though.
We have developed a sensitivity for that. And by focusing on that, we're reframing the focus to the 1 in 1 million people who have a severe allergy to the vaccine, and we're taking away from the 1 in 5 to 1 in 6 children who develop a severe disease, have to be hospitalized, or even with COVID. 1 in 1 million people will have a severe reaction. Is that a risk? Absolutely. I will take that risk over the 8 in 100 chance that I will be hospitalized with it. And so that's what you're doing, is really looking at the risk and where do you want to take your risk. Some people say, I will take the risk of being the between 1 in 8 in 100 who is hospitalized with COVID rather than the 1 in 1 million who has a severe reaction to the vaccine. And that is definitely your choice. Those of us who play the odds might say, I'll take the vaccine. We love to play the odds. We love sports. We love who's the odds of winning. If you gamble, where are the odds of the best blackjack table? You know, we like to play the odds. And so I think that that applies to vaccines rather than natural disease as well.
So you mentioned COVID. Let's talk about the COVID shot and whether or not it's available to people now or under what conditions. So this was discussed on Thursday when the Secretary of Health, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., was testifying before the Senate, and he had a back and forth with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren about that. Let's give a listen.
Last November, while you were under consideration to become Secretary of Health and Human Services, Mr. Kennedy, you said, quote, If vaccines are working for somebody, I'm not going to take them away. No exceptions, no ifs, ands, or buts. You would not take away vaccines from anyone who wanted them. Then last week, you announced that the COVID-19 vaccine is no longer approved for healthy people under the age of 65. In announcing the change, you said the vaccine will be available for anyone who wants it. Now, obviously, both things cannot be true at the same moment. So let's clear this up right now, Secretary Kennedy. Will you tell America that all adults and all children over 6 months of age are eligible to get a COVID booster at their local pharmacy today?
Anybody can get the booster.
I'm sorry?
Anybody can get it, Senator.
Anybody. So you're saying that is now the official rule of HHS. Anybody is eligible to get a booster by just walking into the pharmacy.
It's not recommended for healthy people.
No. If you don't recommend, then the consequence of that in many states is that you can't walk into a pharmacy and get one. It means insurance companies don't have to cover the $200 or so cost. As Senator Dr. Cassidy said, you are effectively denying people vaccines.
We're not going to recommend a product for which there's no clinical data for that indication. Is that what I should be doing?
What you should be doing is honoring your promise that you made when you were looking to get confirmed in this job.
You're going
and
like this.
That is, you promised that you would not take away vaccines from anyone who wanted them. You just changed the classification of the COVID vaccine.
I'm not taking them away from people, Senator.
It takes it away if you can't get it from your pharmacist.
Well, most Americans are going to be able to get it from their pharmacy for free. Most Americans will be able to get it from their pharmacy
for free. The question is, everyone who wants it, that was your promise,
I know,
Mr.
I didn't.
Kennedy,
no, I never
mine.
Promised that I was going to recommend products with which there is no indication.
All right, and that goes on and on for several more minutes, back and forth, and just spins further and further into absurdity. But Dr. Aaron Carlson, what did you hear there?
So what I heard there... there's a lot of layers. So for one is Senator Warren is alluding to the fact that now under Secretary Kennedy, the FDA vaccine policy has been significantly narrowed in practice. So the approval and recommendations for updated COVID vaccines have been restricted now under the new FDA narrowing of approval to older and high risk groups. So you have to be 65 or older or be in a high risk medical category to be those for whom the vaccine is approved. Now, there's some layers there as far as how you can get the vaccine if you can get the vaccine. That is still under debate because here's what's happened. The FDA has limited its authorization of the updated COVID-19 vaccines. Okay. But the FDA is not the final say as far as how that is implemented in medical practice. They just approve the scope. So what happens then, typically, what normally happens is as soon as the FDA has an approval like that, or a change in scope of approval, then it immediately goes to CDC. It's the committee, the advisory committee on immunization practice. And then immediately from the FDA, it goes to this advisory committee on immunization practice, and they issue the guidance that healthcare providers and insurance companies follow for how this is implemented. And what has happened is we're missing that step. So we have the new FDA's scope of approval, but we don't have any guidance issued from the CDC because after that FDA change, Secretary Kennedy dismantled the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice. And so healthcare providers are in limbo. Some won't write a prescription because they say, I don't have the guidelines. Insurers don't know who's going to be covered. Pharmacists are in limbo. Can I give this vaccine without a prescription or not? So you're getting pharmacy roulette, you're getting physician roulette right now because there is not guidance that has been issued.
So Terry Burke, about if I go to the pharmacy today here in Texas, because Texas is a state that does not require a prescription now to get the COVID vaccine. Am I going to get it?
I think it's going to depend. We're actually trying to do a little quick survey to get the answer to that. Clearly people over 65 should be able to without any difficulty. The issue is the folks who need it and want it. Now, the good news is a number of medical associations have been stepping up to replace, if you will, to the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the pediatricians, the cardiologists, the OBGYNs have all issued vaccine guidance like we used to get from the committee.
So the CDC has lost its trust.
Yeah, because CDC's lost its trust. And so I haven't specifically seen, this has all been, as you point out, just very sudden. So I haven't seen whether they've actually sent guidance out on the COVID vaccine. I know also, we know, that when ACIP was dismantled so unceremoniously, the American Association of Hospitals, health insurance, I've got my acronym screwed up here. But anyway, the health insurance companies came out and said they were going to continue to cover vaccines and the cost of them, and that they were going to do that regardless of
because ACIP it makes economic sense for them. They'd rather the cost of a vaccine than cover the cost of a ventilator.
Yeah, I mean, yes. the measles, we haven't got all the cost on the Texas measles outbreak yet, but in 20 something years ago, the state of Washington had a measles outbreak, and they came up with a cost of $47,000 per case. So that's measles.
It'll be expensive.
Forget COVID.
So I got to take a break here. I'll get Randall on the air when we come back from the break. Our phone line is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I do want to talk about the mRNA vaccine question as well, and what damage is being done with the CDC on rolling back support for that research. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about what's happening, public policy in regards to vaccinations, and how it is becoming more and more difficult in order to get a COVID shot, or it's easier to get your kids exempt from being childhood vaccinations before they go to school. What does that mean for public health? And you can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. Let's go to Randall. Randall, thank you for holding on, and you're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot. So earlier you were talking about Hobbs, New Mexico, and you talked about how so many of the Gaines County residents took their families 20 miles across the state line into Hobbs to do all their shopping and so forth. So if we had all these unvaccinated Gaines County children going into this other community, what was the measles outbreak like in Hobbs, New Mexico, and also what were the vaccination rates like in the New Mexico area? Were they higher or lower than Texas?
All right, Randall, thank you for that, because this is a good opportunity to look at when you have public policy like in New Mexico, where they don't have these exemption loopholes so easily available. Also, you have a more robust response, even though New Mexico doesn't have all the resources that Texas has. You saw a big difference. And Terry, what did you see?
So it was, Randall, you're absolutely right. There were far fewer measles cases in New Mexico, although they had, last I saw, they had more than 100 cases. But again, dramatically fewer than we did in Texas. And we believe that's because New Mexico doesn't allow the rate of exemptions that we do in Texas. They allow a religious exemption. But they have to provide a statement of the religious reasons and a letter from a church from their faith leader. Personal and philosophical exemptions, such as we have in Texas, are not permitted. and they do a lot of outreach to ensure that vaccinations occur, particularly for children. So I think that was probably the big difference. And so their immunization rates are higher, though I have seen anecdotal information that New Mexico immunization rates are not as strong as they used to be.
Let's go to Leslie on the Leslie, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Hello?
Hi, I just, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you fine now.
Hello?
Yes,
you hear me okay?
I hear you fine. You're good.
I appreciate it. I just wanted to say that I do agree with Robert F. Kennedy's notion there on, you know, limiting or just not recommending the vaccines. I think there's still, you know, people who want to get them can still get them if they want to, but I agree with the fact that it shouldn't be recommended, especially if there isn't enough evidence there to dictate that it's helping people. You know, I have some small children on my own, and I know people who have been injured by vaccines, and for me personally, it's risky, and if there's not enough evidence there to show that it's safe or effective, then I agree that they shouldn't be recommending it, unless there's some strong evidence there that, you know, two-year-old children need to get the vaccine and it's going to protect them, then why recommend it? So, you know, I just wanted to say that. Thank you.
Well, Leslie, thanks for calling. I appreciate your weighing in on that. Dr. Aaron, if you talk about when Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is saying, we can't recommend this vaccine booster that has not gone through a clinical trial, can you kind of break that down, like why that may not be a good faith argument?
Yes. There is a fair amount of misinformation and disinformation that is being promoted right now about vaccines. So there is zero chance that a vaccine could get to market in the United States without going through rigorous, rigorous clinical trials and being very carefully and rigorously tested for safety. There is some inaccurate information that has unfortunately been promoted. And I feel for parents who are really, like this caller, really studying it, really trying to do the right thing for their children. Everyone just wants to do the right thing for their children. Unfortunately, it's getting harder and harder to know what that is because of how information is being presented. So for instance, Secretary Kennedy said recently that children get between 69 and 92 immunizations by age 18. I don't know where that number's coming from. That's categorically false. That's inaccurate. I'm not saying anyone's intentionally being inaccurate about that, but that is inaccurate. All you have to do is go to the
He should know the actual number. He should know the accurate number.
Right. If you're going to make claims about vaccines, you should know the accurate number. And so go to the American Academy of Pediatrics and you see it's nowhere near 69 to 92. I think any of us who've been fully vaccinated know we didn't get 92 or even 69 shots when we were a kid. So there's things like that that are being said, and there's inaccurate information being said about the rigorous testing. And that's where scientists come in. That's where people who have trained in this, who have MDs and PhDs, and both MDs and PhDs, and who have spent years training in this. You know, I don't go to an attorney for my medical advice, and I don't go to a doctor for my legal advice, and I don't go to a mechanic for my plumbing advice, right? And so we need to think about who we are going to, who are the experts, and go to them and seek credible information from the source of people who have been trained and are well experienced in that field.
Let's go to Deborah on the phones. Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to reach out to the people who do not believe in vaccines and are so worried about vaccinating their children. I just want to know how much more research has to be done, because vaccines have been going on since, what, 1800s. 1964, 1984 World Health Organization, 1995 the American Academy of Family Physicians, all have researched vaccinations. Like, they are safe. I think it's a point of being selfish, and all they're thinking about is themselves, instead of thinking about the greater good. Even our president, George Washington, believed in vaccines, that he was vaccinating for smallpox. And if it wasn't for that vaccine, we probably would still be a British colony. Like, vaccines have been researched enough. How many more years of research do we need until people realize that vaccines are safe?
All right, Deborah, thank you for that. So this is even before we had a grasp of germ theory or even viruses and you know, Louis Pasteur, things like that. But there was a belief that if you were you could inoculate yourself against smallpox, and he ordered all of the revolutionary forces to do that, and it saved lives, and it helped keep the army healthy. But Terry Burke, really quickly, from the Immunization Partnership, what does polling tell us about support for vaccinations in America?
Yeah, polling Texans in particular, because I know Texans best, but Americans across every state are hugely supportive of vaccination. We have polled on this. The University of Texas Polling Center, which is very respected, has polled on it all in the last year. And we've seen, and then nationally, the Pew Center for Research, we've seen that, you know, around 79-80% of Americans believe children should be vaccinated, period, full stop. And so it is interesting to me that we've had three callers and two of them question vaccines. That would seem to be inconsistent with those polling numbers, but it speaks to, I think, I think we all have to acknowledge that we didn't, that the information about COVID, the COVID vaccine, was not pushed out as well as it might have been. Easy to say now.
Well, yeah. But, so let me ask you really quick. We're running out of time, but I want to get this out there. Florida is planning to drop all school vaccine mandates. That will probably take effect in 90 days. Now they're revising that, and so they will still keep the polio and other big diseases. But so what's happening in Florida, and why is that a cautionary tale, Terry? Real quick.
Well, first of all, it really can't happen in 90 days. Most of those are embedded in law, and they're going to have to go through the legislature. And I'd like to note my gratitude to President Trump. On Friday afternoon, he said very unequivocally that there are a lot of vaccines that really are extraordinary. He called them amazing, and he wasn't certain that this was such a great idea. But it is a cautionary tale for Texas, because Texas and Florida tend to run a race to the bottom, and that's what worries us.
Okay, and so, Jeff, I can't get you on the air. We're out of time, but his question is, too many vaccines for kids, and so, Dr. Carlson, is that true?
I would say go to the American Academy of Pediatrics for any concerns you have and see what their stance is. Those are the physicians who treat our children and help keep them safe, and that is where you go, and they say, no, not too many vaccinations for children.
And so there's too many diseases coming after our kids.
The germs still exist. It is only the vaccines and the preventive measures that are keeping us from having the germs. The germs are still here, folks.
All right, well, even though we have vaccinations that have been keeping us safe, and so maybe we've been letting our guards down, and we're seeing what happened with the measles and the loss of two young girls, and hopefully we won't have any more tragic events like that in the future, but it's hard to say. I want to thank you, Dr. Aaron Carlson, at the College of Nursing and Health Innovation at UT Arlington, and Terry Burke, Executive Director of the Immunization Partnership. Thank you so much. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.